next argument this morning will be in Schultz against the Aviol Long-Term Disability Plan. Mr. Dubofsky.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dubofsky. I represent the plaintiff's appellants in this action. The principal issue raised on appeal is that by drafting the policy in the manner in which, or the policies in the manner in which Prudential did, the insurance company limited itself with respect to dependent Social Security benefits to only be able to offset dependent benefits when the dependent himself or herself is disabled. Prudential used a specific term of art in their policies: loss of time disability benefits in one policy, loss of time disability payments in the other policy that's in the record. The difference is really immaterial. Loss of time itself is a term of art that is defined by the leading authorities on insurance law, the Couch text and the Appleman text, as meaning loss of business time connected with the insured's occupation or time away from the insured's occupation, which is not necessarily total disability. A situation can certainly exist where one is away from their occupation, but they might be the owner of the occupation and still received exactly the same compensation that they received before, even if they had to hire somebody to fulfill their duties. An example or examples of situations that are not loss of time disability benefits are veterans benefits or workers' comp benefits, where workers' compensation benefits are often paid because of loss of a limb or loss of sight. Those are not loss of time benefits. Loss of time benefits are very specifically related to the inability to work in one's occupation. The dependent Social Security disability benefits do not compensate for the child's loss of time.
That's perfectly obvious. But what the plan says is that the referent to loss of time is the benefits that accrue because of the participant's loss of time, not the child's loss of time. And your whole argument is that unless the benefits are because of the child's loss of time, they're outside the scope of this coordination clause. Why is the plan obliged to read that language as referring to the child's loss of time rather than the wage earner's loss of time?
Your Honor, because of the way in which the policies are drafted. The policies do not clearly state that it is the wage earner or the insured's loss of time. The policies indicate in the Schultz policy, the Aviol policy, the amount that you, your spouse, and children receive or are entitled to receive as loss of time disability payments because of your disability under the Social Security Act. The Perkins-Coie policy, which is identical in wording to the policy in the Karstens case, says that the policy has the right to offset periodic benefits payable to you, your spouse, or children. And then periodic benefits are defined as loss of time disability benefits payable under or by reason of the United States Social Security Act. But the wording is unclear. And unlike the cases that the defendant is relying on that involve interpretation under a discretionary or an abuse of discretion standard of...
Let's go back. I'm willing to grant that the placement of the words is awkward. But is there any such thing as loss of time disability benefits for children?
Absolutely.
They've never been wage earners. Under the Social Security Act, loss of time disability benefits is something that wage earners can get, which children weren't. They get benefits on somebody else's account, not because of their own loss of time. So on your view, what you want us to do is read the ambiguity in a way that makes it legally nonsensical. The plan wants to read the ambiguity in a way that actually makes sense.
No, we want the court to read the ambiguity in the way in which the policy is written. And just as the primary wage earner's disability can arguably be considered loss of time, the only situations under the Social Security Act where a dependent would have a loss of time, an inability to work in an occupation, is if the dependent himself or herself is disabled. And the Social Security Act clearly delineates circumstances under which that can take place.
Let me see if I understand this, Mr. Dabowski. Let's take as simple an example as I can craft. Two families, each consisting of one parent and one child. The parent is disabled. One child is disabled, the other is not. If I understand your position, the family in which the child is disabled is subject to a substantially greater offset for these private benefits. Is that right?
Based on the way Prudential drafted the policy, is correct.
Perhaps that's what my colleague was referring to with respect to legal nonsense. I mean, does that result make any sense at all?
I'm not sure if it makes sense, but I'm not sure that allowing the offset of the dependent benefits makes legal sense, because the whole purpose of ERISA is to protect contractually defined benefits. The Prudential policies say that you will receive 60% of your pre-disability earnings, but if they get to offset the dependent benefits, which cannot be used except for the purposes of the dependent, that's less money that the insured has.
I understand that you don't like the dependent offsets, but there's something that's part of this policy, and you seem to be advocating a result that, frankly, is really peculiar.
But so is the language of the policy. These are the only policies, other than the one referenced in the Karstens case, that use this unusual terminology, loss of time disability payment. Every other insurance company that writes disability insurance seems to have figured out how to write the policy in a way that it is clearly stated what is offsettable and what is not offsettable. And that was the point that the Third Circuit was making in the Unisys case, in that the court says that we interpret the contract looking for linguistic reference points. And because it's a simple matter of draftsmanship, if they fail to state what they intend to state, the court should not supply the subjective intent. The court should supply the policy language as objectively written. And it's objectively written in this case.
Do you really have any basis for this argument other than the Carson case, which has been rejected by the Ninth Circuit?
The Carson's case has not been rejected by the Ninth Circuit, Your Honor. The Carson's case was rejected in another district court opinion.
Well, another district court opinion in the Ninth Circuit.
But the language in that case was different. This case and the Carson's case are the only reported cases that we were able to find that dealt with that unusual terminology of loss of time disability payments. And because of the use of that awkward language, Prudential created an ambiguity in the policy. And since this case is adjudicated under the de novo standard, the rule of contra pro forentum would apply. And under that rule, the ambiguity must be construed against the drafter of the policy and in favor of the policyholder. I'll turn my attention now to the second issue before the court, and that's whether the district court erred in dismissing Prudential as a defendant in this case. As we have argued...
What turns on this? Okay, this was a puzzle to me when I read both your brief and the secretary's brief, because to be blunt, I can't see that anything depends on this. You sue the plan, you get a judgment against the plan. If the plan has insurance, it turns to the insurer to pay the judgment. And that's the way things normally work in insurance law. What turns on this?
What turns on this is a matter of procedural regularity and convenience. I can give the court an example of a case from New Mexico where the insurance company refused to step up and defend the plan, which led to a garnishment proceeding, and the case lasted for several years. It's Kirby versus Guardian Life, 231 Pacific 3rd, 87. It's the same reason, Your Honor, why Willie Sutton robbed banks, because that's where the money is. The insurance company has written the policy.
If you imagine the case where the insurer says we're not liable, if you sue the insurer directly, the insurer may say directly we're not liable. Let me put this a different way. What you effectively want is to make ERISA a direct action statute. If you look at ordinary insurance disputes in state law, we've got a minority of states that are direct action states where you can sue the insurer, and the vast majority of states you have to sue the wrongdoer, and the wrongdoer then can bring in the insurer. So you want us to treat ERISA as a direct action law. Now, we were told in Firestone that gaps in ERISA should be filled the way they're normally filled in private law. And one would think that normal way insurance disputes are handled in private law is not to sue the insurer directly. So why should ERISA adopt the minority view?
First of all, Your Honor, it's a matter of statutory construction.
No, it's not a matter of statutory construction. The Secretary, perhaps you may disavow what the Secretary says. The Secretary says ERISA is completely open on this. ERISA doesn't answer this question. Listen to us. We're experts. And it's true. ERISA just doesn't answer this question. So we have to make up a common law rule. That's the Firestone problem. The question I'm asking is why we should depart from what is the normal private law rule, which is you sue the wrongdoer, and the wrongdoer deals with its own insurer.
In the situation that the court is referring to, such as the typical personal injury action, you sue the tortfeasor even if the tortfeasor is insured. But when, in the normal course of insurance litigation, when you have a direct action against the insurance company, you sue the insurance company. This is a direct action.
Look, well, you're talking. Listen to my question. My question says, if you look at states, a distinct minority, fewer than 10, are direct action states. And I understood Firestone to tell us when we've got openings in ERISA to use the normal rule from private law. That normal rule seems to be not direct action. So why should we adopt the minority rule?
With all respect, Your Honor, I think you're confusing the situation in personal injury cases with the normal situation in insurance cases, where if you have a direct claim against the insurance company. If my house burns down, I don't sue municipality.
That's when you are the insured, right? But here, the employer is the insured,
the
beneficiary, your client is the beneficiary of a plan.
They're named third-party beneficiaries of the plan. They have the action, and the insurance company is making the decision. And this circuit has now become the outlying circuit on this issue.
Has the Second Circuit changed its position?
The Second Circuit is still open on the issue.
I thought they had
open.
I thought they agreed with us on this.
I don't think that there has been a recent ruling from the Second Circuit.
No.
Let's go.
It doesn't make it open. It just means there hasn't been a recent ruling.
It also tends to suggest that I'd like to go back to, in essence, how important this question is. I understand the difference between third-party insurance and a situation that you've got here where the insurance company is the drafter of the policy, the decision maker. We see that a lot, obviously, in under ERISA. But what difference does this make?
It's just a matter of procedural convenience, bringing the proper party that's responsible for making the payment before the court. The plan isn't making the payment. The insurance company is making
the insurance payment. The insurance company is an agent for the plan in this situation. We can debate the metaphysics for a while, but are there claimants going unpaid because of this rule?
In the case that I cited from New Mexico, the Kirby case.
Okay, that's one where apparently any others? I mean, is this a persistent problem?
I'm not certain. That was the only one that I located while I was preparing for the oral argument.
Well, you and the Secretary of Labor are urging us to reconsider this line of precedent, and maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, but I'm just trying to get a sense of how important it is.
I think it's significant, Your Honor. I think that just as the example I gave before, if my house burned down and my insurance company didn't pay, I wouldn't want to sue somebody other than the insurance company because they're the party that's ultimately going to be responsible for the payment. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Grossberg.
May it please the Court, John Grossberg. I'll be speaking on behalf of all three appellees this morning. Respectfully, the district court here got it completely correct. There is nothing superficial about the district court's analysis, as it has been characterized in the briefs in this court by the appellants. It's straightforward and easy. In this context, and all of this is contextual, obviously, loss of time is not a term of art, but it's a reference to loss of time from work and the concomitant loss of income as a result. It could say loss of income, it could say loss of time. The meaning is the same. Loss of time disability payments under Social Security, which is what the offset here refers to, among other things, means benefits receivable under the disability provisions of the Social Security Act or the various other similar acts and plans that the offset makes, the offset language in the policies makes reference to. And finally, loss of time disability payments paid to children because of your disability. That's the language of the plan. That's the language that is unambiguous and clear, as the district court found.
Has the plan ever taken a position related to Mr. Dubofsky's? If you think about Judge Hamilton's question, you have the rare case where children's benefits under the Social Security Act are paid on account of a child's permanent disability. Has the plan ever deducted those benefits from amounts payable to a participant?
Not to my knowledge, and it is our position that would not be within the offset. That would be outside the offset.
Well, on your reading, it would certainly be outside the offset. I was trying to figure out whether the plan is being consistent.
It is our belief.
If the plan had done that, it would certainly get the Ebenezer Scrooge Award.
It would get the Ebenezer Scrooge Award, and I think it would be violating the language of the plan document or the policy in this case.
That's not a payment because of, quote, your disability.
I'm sorry?
That's not a payment because of, quote, your disability.
Absolutely not. There's only one. When you look at the Social Security Act in 402D, and you got to drill down, but it's 402D1 capital B little I within parentheses. That is the benefit that comes to a dependent if the dependent is a minor and the parent is disabled. It has nothing to do with the minor's condition. It has nothing to do with the minor's need for the money.
Mr. Grossberg, let me ask you about the standard of review here, because I'm frankly a little confused about this.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be agreeing that given the motion that was filed, this is de novo review, but you want to reserve the right in the event of remand to argue for deferential review.
That is, I would phrase it a little differently, that's largely correct.
On the basis of documents that apparently have not been produced in response to requests?
There have been no discovery below. This comes to this court on a Rule 12b-6 motion where
Did the beneficiary submit written requests for the relevant plan documents?
There have been no discovery even propounded.
Not discovery, a statutory request under ERISA.
You're talking about in the administrative?
The one that triggers the $100 a day penalty.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to whether that request was specifically made or not. I was not involved prior to this lawsuit. I cannot personally answer that question.
Well, you're telling us that you've got a secret stash of documents that will let you invoke discretionary deferential review in the future. And that's sort of a troubling prospect for us. It sounds like you're asking for an advisory opinion here.
We're asking you to rule de novo at this juncture because what is in the record on this motion to dismiss, this Rule 12b-6 motion, doesn't contain the language of deference that
well,
would
look,
be necessary
we're gonna
to sustain that standard of review, that more liberal standard of review.
But you say there are such documents?
Yes, I do. Yeah, frankly, they're on the table right over here.
And are they referred to in the complaint?
No.
Specifically or general references to the plan?
The complaint attaches the policy.
Well, sure, but the complaint refers to the plan, right?
Well, first of all, the complaint names the plan as the disability portion of the plan only. It doesn't even the plan is the health and welfare.
Let me try to make this more specific. Is there any reason why you could not rely on those documents in your 12b-6 motion because the plan is the basis of the complaint?
I suppose we could have opted with an affidavit to put that document into evidence at that juncture. Whether that would have converted this to a summary judgment?
It would not. That's very clear. And this frankly smacks of gamesmanship that may or may not have any bottom line effect here, but is pretty troubling.
Well, I can assure the court there was no intention of gamesmanship. We were reacting in a 12b-6 motion to that which is part of the complaint. That included the disability policies that are at issue, not the broader plan document that is the umbrella for all the various benefits that Avial and Perkins Coie provide, life insurance.
But that you contend covers this dispute, correct?
Not at this juncture. We will contend that if you find an ambiguity.
You contend that it covers this dispute,
yes,
right?
We do.
Okay. There's a good deal of wasting of the court's time in this by failing to present those relevant documents. Whether there was a problem or a violation in failing to produce them to the plaintiff, I don't know.
There was no intent to waste anyone's time and no intent in gamesmanship. And what I am telling the court now in terms of our position on standard review is at this juncture, the language is plain and unambiguous in this context. That's the basis on which Judge Castile below ruled, and that's the basis we're asking, obviously, for this court's affirmance. Plain and unambiguous language, not a more liberal standard.
Let me ask you about the question of the proper defendant. If Prudential is not a proper party, as you know, under the MetLife against Glenn case, there are we kind of have this new world of discovery and issues into conflicts of interest,
correct,
particularly where the plan administrator, like an insurance company, is also basically deciding about its own bottom line costs under the policy. Does it matter, for example, for discovery purposes, whether discovery aimed at the plan administrator insurance company is a party to the case or not a party to the case?
It shouldn't, because any documents that were literally only in the possession of Prudential as opposed to the plan itself would be subject to being subpoenaed under the normal discovery rules, it seems to me.
How about, no, you can't serve interrogatories on non-parties.
Could not, but you could take the 30B6 deposition and effectively accomplish the same thing.
Mm-hmm. That's the difference.
A bigger,
I mean, that's the difference.
I mean,
you can't serve requests to admit, you can't serve interrogatories on non-parties.
That is true, but I don't think as a practical matter the non-party escapes by dint of being a non-party, escapes having to provide the relevant information and do all the
presumably you've got a customer who would want you to be pretty responsive under these circumstances.
Well, that's for sure. The other thing on the so-called moat rule and its importance, it's more than just is the insurance company a proper party or not. Obviously, it's our position that it is not a proper party. But it seems to be the position, as I understand it, of the appellants in this case, and perhaps even the Department of Labor, although less clear here, is that the plans themselves don't need to be parties. And that's, it seems to me, ticket for mischief. I mean, this case is styled as a class action in order to rope in every approved disability policy that's out there. Having to name the plans themselves puts an immediate obstacle in the way of that attempt. Clearly, if you look at Supreme, whether it's MetLife versus Glenn or any of the more recent Supreme Court cases dealing with ERISA and the importance of...
The word clearly does not belong within hailing distance of MetLife against Glenn.
Well, I think Justice Roberts has been, if nothing else, consistent in his talking about the underlying importance of ERISA clarity and efficiencies and cost-effective administration and the like, and somehow releasing plan participants from their obligation when they're seeking plan benefits to sue the plan strikes me as a convoluted way, not only for all the reasons Judge Eastbrook alluded to in his comments, but here as well. There is no good reason for divorcing, for separating from prior precedent in this court. And indeed, you would think the Department of Labor, who supposedly keeps track of these things, would have some sort of empirical basis to make the assertions of problems, if that's what they are, with respect to not being able to name insurance companies. None of that was presented in their attempt to intervene as an amicus
returning
in this
to
case.
Judge Easterbrook's line of questioning, do you think this is somewhat analogous to the existence of direct action statutes?
I think that is directly apt, and yes, I do. The plan is...
As you're probably aware, Wisconsin has had a direct action statute for many years. Utilized very successfully in suing insurance.
Do work with insurance policies in Wisconsin, and no argument there, Judge. But just a year ago in Feinberg, this court talked about the plan being the primary obligor. The plan is on the hook here. The plan needs to be a party. The plan is where your recourse is. And the insurance issues are secondary to that. There's no hint that these plans for a Boeing subsidiary and a large law firm can't meet their obligations, if they have any, under the policies at issue. Lastly, I'll just finish. The contra preferendum came up. It has absolutely no place in this case where there's not been a complete record after discovery regarding things like relative sophistication of the parties, whether there really is an ambiguity in this policy. We say there is no ambiguity. There's no need for contra-preferendum whatsoever. Unless the court has further questions, we'll stand.
Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much, Mr. Grosshart. Anything further, Mr. Dabowski? You probably have 30 seconds.
Then I have time for two brief points. First is there is absolutely nothing in this record that shows any distinction between the policy and the plan. And the second point I want to make is that I will accept what Mr. Grosspart said about whether offsets have been taken where the dependent is disabled, but there is no evidence before the court of that. And the way these policies are structured, the insurance company can very well take that offset, too, if this court upholds Prudential's construction of the plan. So for those reasons, We believe that the decision below needs to be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.